You don't have to be a machine learning engineer to help make the future a smarter place. Become an agent of innovation with Invesco QQQ. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Is realizing the full value of your network just a dream? Intel is bringing AI everywhere, building solutions to help modernize and monetize 5G infrastructure, making it possible for telecommunications providers to expand services and drive efficiency by reducing costs and saving energy. The next wave of networks starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
Welcome to Trillions. I'm Joel Weber.
And I'm Eric Balchunas.
Eric, do you remember the before times? Because we had an interview back in March with someone that we never aired, and we, you know, dusted it off for this week's episode, and I'm excited to revisit it.
It was like days of innocence. I was so much younger back then in early March.
I miss you. I miss you. I really do.
I know.
It will be normal again someday. So our guest is Tim Clift of InvestNet. And we found him through actually Morgan Barna, who's in Bloomberg Intelligence and is an analyst with you. And Morgan flagged him because he's got this huge team of research analysts who help him have this platform that interfaces with more than 100,000 advisors, which I thought was really interesting because we always talk about products and ETFs, but we don't talk about platforms that much.
Yeah, I think for somebody who isn't in the business, a good way to put it would be like, the platform is sort of like the Costco or Whole Foods for advisors. So if you have an advisor that you use, they, especially one that doesn't, that has broken away from the sort of wirehouses like the Merrills or UBSs and is on their own independent, they would use an InvestNet to shop for individual ETFs, funds, or packages of them in a sort of wholesale manner. So what's interesting to me about this conversation in regards to what's going on now in the market is we've seen more and more the way we watch flows all the time, and we're seeing more and more that models are impacting the flows. You can tell when a model says, you know what, we're shifting out of, you know, inflation protected securities into corporates or out of equities and into bonds. You can see it in the flows. And so more and more as these ETFs make it into these models, which are put on the shelf at these proverbial Costco or Whole Foods, the more the flows are impacted by what the models do. And the models can be tactical, trading a lot, or strategic, which don't move all that much. And this guy, Tim, is basically sits right in the middle. He's like the gatekeeper of the funds that get on. He also works on making the models, and there's outside people who make the models. So it's a little inside baseball, but I think it's a really interesting look into how the sort of intermediary channel of ETF flows and investing works. So just to give you some scale, you know, InvestNet, this company, has about $75 billion in ETF assets. That's about 2% of all ETF assets. So it's not huge, but it's sizable. But they have 30% growth year over year. And what's also interesting is that in ETF models, though, could be something like 200 to 300 billion. So getting closer to 10%. So again, I think that's the chunk we're really going to focus on today. But InvestNet is, like I said, a portion of that chunk in terms of how they fit into the bigger picture.
So again, Tim Clift of InvestNet. This was recorded in mid-March before our office went on lockdown. So it sounds especially great because we're not all in closets. And special thanks to Morgan Barna for helping make this episode happen.
Yeah, by the way, that's funny you bring that up because remember we wondered which of those ETFs that we pitched in the ETF Tank episode? About 10 of us all pitched products we thought should exist. And we wondered who would be the first to market. And Morgan's won. She pitched a online betting ETF. And it is now a reality. BETZ. And it's an instant hit. It's already got $67 million. Came out of the gate pretty strong. So congratulations to her. Even though I won in that competition with XMON, the X Mondays ETF, she won the real one.
This time on Trillions, investing with InvestNet. Tim, welcome to Trillions.
Thanks for having me.
So what do you do at InvestNet?
I wear a lot of different hats, but my primary responsibility is for research and portfolio management for the organization. So we have a team of analysts that do research on mutual funds, ETFs, all sorts of different investment products, and then make recommendations to financial advisors and to our own portfolio managers that will build model portfolios.
Eric thinks you're Whole Foods. How do you describe yourself?
I think that's a great description. You know, we could be the Amazon.
Owned by Amazon.
But we are a big open architecture platform, so we don't necessarily start from a curation standpoint. We open our doors to just about everybody, but we do have teams in-house that help advisors and organizations get that list smaller.
And I think that the real important thing for people here to understand who might be retail investors themselves is advisors, wealth managers, they don't necessarily do it all themselves. They will outsource a lot of things. So just talk to us about the shoppers at your, quote, platform. The people who use them are advisors. What are they getting from you, and how are ETFs involved?
Yeah, I mean, historically, advisors, a lot of their practice was built around them building their own models. And I think over time, they've understood or have figured out that that's maybe not the best use of their time, that they really need to spend more time with their clients putting together financial plans.
So who can I pay to make these problems go away? And that's you.
Exactly. So, you know, the advisors now are saying, well, maybe it makes sense for this segment of my business just to go into model portfolios. They all have very different appetite for risk, different time horizons. But within the model structure, you can actually fit a lot of different people into a limited number of model portfolios that will make sense for those.
Okay, so model portfolio, model structures, what does any of that mean?
So think of a model portfolio as a selection of mutual funds or ETFs. Now, ETFs are the ones that are growing the fastest with different risk tolerances. So maybe you have 3, 5, 10 different mutual funds or ETFs in the portfolio. And those will change over time as the economy changes or the direction of the goals of the client change. But it's a set portfolio of these underlying securities.
And are these tailored for me as an individual, or are they more off-the-shelf products?
So they start off relatively off-the-shelf. So there may be 7 or 10 in a risk spectrum, so from very conservative to very aggressive. And there may be tax-efficient versions of those. But there's also tools you can set on top of these model portfolios. So you could say, well, I want to have an ESG or an impact component to it, or I want to add a income infusion to it. So you can do some customization to these, but by and large, they start off at least as structured individual portfolios.
Most people out there know the 60-40, 60% equity, 40% bonds, and you could do that with two ETFs now. I'm assuming, you know, if you were to describe one of these portfolios, I know you can't say tickers. We'll say them for you if we need to. But go through what one might look like. Is it, you know, 50, 30, 10? Like, what's going on here? What's an example of one?
What's the composition?
Would you put Joel in, basically?
Yeah, so there are very simple ones, and sometimes those will just be for a low-cost solution. So, you know, you can come into these model portfolios with $5,000 and get into a model portfolio, but that's only going to have a couple of different tickers to it. The larger the cases and the more diversified the portfolio, you might have 10 or 15, but they'll generally have certainly equity and fixed income and international exposure. In some cases, they will have alternatives exposure in them too. In some cases, these are almost set it, forget it, like strategic models where they don't change much at all over time, and others that may be more tactical and move in and out of the markets a little bit more and be more flexible with what's going on in the environment.
How would model portfolios help with rebalancing? How would that help the advisor community?
So with model portfolios, you are outsourcing all the selection part of it, but also the rebalancing part of the portfolio. So every time the market moves significantly, that rebalancing will happen either from a manager standpoint or InvestNet and our platform will do that. We can set it up and say, well, let's just do it every quarter or once a year or when it hits a certain tolerance and it moves outside of that risk spectrum that you signed up for.
So it seems to me, and you know, the recent sell-offs we've been seeing, we have seen a lot of the core ETFs from Vanguard, like IVV and VU and IEFA and VEA, continue to take in money during the sell-offs. correct me if I'm wrong, it seems like model portfolios are part of where the flows are coming from, despite the market conditions. Advisors say, hey, look, we're going to just use this model, done. Now I'm going to spend all my time right now coaching this investor to not sell. And that's their big value add now. Now they don't have to spend their time as much doing that. Is that kind of what's going on now, and what explains some of the flows into these ETFs despite the market some violent days, actually?
It is. I mean, these are much stickier assets. And by and large, they're part of a financial plan. So the advisor sat down with a client. They've gone through the long-term goals for the client. And they're saying, this makes the most sense for you. We are not going to jump in and jump out of the market every time something scary happens temporarily. These are long-term holdings. If you need short-term assets, put it somewhere else. These models are really here to, you know, generate income over time and to grow over time. And so you don't see those flows nearly as much as individual tickers.
And what kind of time horizon are you typically talking about there?
Yeah, the time horizons might be 10 years, 15, 20, 30, you know, all the way through retirement. So it could be a 50-year time horizon on many of these models.
Can I throw a theory at you that I've been thinking about? There's this general feeling that, like, okay, ETFs are going to hurt the market because all these people are going to run when something gets tough, and there'll be like only one door. Like everybody's going to try to run out the same exit door. It seems like every single sell-off, we see the same thing. We see the ETFs tend to take in net flows, as do index mutual funds, which are passive. It seems to me traditionally those are younger clients and more coached clients by these advisors. Now, mutual funds, people were put in there by a broker who got paid from the mutual fund, so less loyalty, and traditionally boomers who may have a shorter time horizon. Could we be looking at a situation for the next at least 15, 20 years where sell-offs are more about mutual funds having to sell and being under severe pressure rather than the passive side? Is that something you can speak to from where you sit?
Yes.
He wrestles with big theories.
it's a big theory, I don't want anyone to think that we're not going to see outflows out of ETFs too as markets get, you know, struggle. I just think that you may not have as much fluidity. I think the way the trend has been, it's really more a function of cost. So, you know, I think that's where ETFs have an advantage. And we've seen, by and large, advisors more and more focused when they're putting portfolios together for their clients. There's much more fee pressure. So anytime they meet with a brand new client and they're in a mutual fund model, very often they're going to be recommending an ETF model or a blended model for their client to reduce the cost, because we know that particularly in down markets, additional costs are just going to eat away and corrode at your returns.
But the person who sought out the ETF is they bought it. They weren't put in it. And I think that's important because usually that person also is a student of behavioral finance as well and has long-term mentality, understands, as we say, they're chasing patience, not performance.
And so I think that for anyone that's going into these models, I think that's absolutely true, that we're not going to see a lot of that friction and movement in and out. But I also think, you know, ETFs are being used from a hedging vehicle, and because you can intraday trade them, there's going to be some movement there. But I think in the models, for sure, we don't see nearly the outflows that we'd see in other asset classes.
Yeah, given the interest you're seeing in ETF-only model portfolios, what is your take on the new active non-transparent funds coming to market? Do you think, you know, part of the appeal is that they fit into an ETF-only model portfolio? What is your sort of take on?
Yeah, I think that's pretty exciting, the non-transparent ETFs that are moving into the marketplace. It'll allow those traditionally beta-only or just, you know, tracking the market type of portfolios to have the ability to outperform. And it gets a lot of really smart portfolio managers into that space, basically moving their traditional mutual fund models into this ETF structure that's more tax sensitive and just a more efficient vehicle, lower cost.
Right. It obviously forces the collapse of the multi-share class, right? They're going to be a single share class. They're probably going to be priced, I mean, looks like a little bit closer to the institutional costs of the mutual fund. Eric and I, you know, we've talked about there's a clear interest in why fund issuers are moving this direction. In part, a lot of these, you know, strategies have seen outflows. But is there really going to be demand? I mean, do you see demand from the advisors asking for more active strategies or asking for ETF-only model portfolios that have a better mix of active and passive.
Yeah, so they're not asking for the non-transparent ETFs yet. I think once they're more broadly available in the marketplace and they've proven themselves out so that the bid asks are tight and the APs can actually create the shares that they need to make that market efficient, I think the assets will flow. We're already seeing the active passive blends, but they're not necessarily the non-transparent active passive. So the best of both worlds, right? You can have smart beta, you can have alpha combined. You get the, you know, when the markets go down, sometimes, you know, the active managers can be a little bit more nimble. So maybe those combined make a lot more sense. So we have advisors building their practice around building active passive portfolios. So I think once the non-transparents get in there, it gives a lot more choice. And again, you get some benefits of that structure.
I do think some of the worry that we will hear with models sometimes is, and we see it with the flows, a lot of the flows do go into the, like, the S&P one, you know, VU or IVV, and then the MSCI EFA one, or the FTSE, and they're very similar. The EM one, which is very similar, either it's MSCI or FTSE. We call it the Core Wars, or the AG or BND, which is the Aggregate Bond Index. Is there any risk to everybody basically hooking into the same portfolio pound for pound? Because from the flows, it doesn't seem like there's a ton of differentiation. But then when you meet with an issuer, they will say that they're a niche issuer, that they can provide an advisor with differentiation. And we see some of that. But largely, it just seems like all the money is going into the same sort of four ETF categories.
And we're seeing that too. So your traditional strategic model has those core elements to it. And that's where 80% of the flows are going into those asset classes. So there, you know, can potentially be some concern around liquidity for those products if there tends to be movement all at the same time. But we also, the issuers and the models that are providing those are the biggest ones out there. So that, you know, we have certain criteria around how many assets they have to have, how long they've been doing this. So we're not as concerned about the liquidity part of it as we would be for a brand new startup. The other thing we're seeing is that advisors are saying, all right, we're going to take that core, but we're going to build around it. So we're going to say, you know, we've got the core four asset classes, and now we're going to add an income boost for my retirement clients. So there's another model portfolio.
Like condiments.
Sprinkle a little relish and mustard,
like some
on the side.
Ketchup on the hot dog. That's what Joel likes.
Exactly.
I like the relish too.
So they'll start building around it and saying, you know, we want a little more income in this portfolio, or we want some different variation. I want liquid alternatives in there somehow so that we can have some downside protection, whatever it might be.
So your clients are basically advisors, right? And we're seeing tons more wealth managers sort of break off and do their own advisor shop. What do you think the potential of your business looks like here as you see more and more of these advisors competing with one another, and what kind of opportunity and strategic growth do you see in the near term?
Yeah, I think, you know, we only see upside right now. The number of advisors that are moving into the model portfolios and out of, you know, old commission products or actually just doing it all themselves. The organizations they work for don't necessarily want them doing that anymore. They'd much rather have the compliance structure, they'd rather have it outsourced to these enormous firms that have a lot of resources rather than having an advisor just going and picking and choosing on their own. You know, if it comes down to some litigation, if they have all this backup that's been done, that's a much safer place to be than doing it themselves.
You don't have to be a rocket scientist to help realize a mission to Mars. Become an agent of innovation with Invesco QQQ. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
You service independent advisors. And, you know, when you talk about Merrill, UBS, and these bigger networks of FAs where they have to sort of subscribe to the Merrill, do you find people defect from there and become independent, and then you're kind of where they would go to use something similar?
Yeah, we see a lot of advisors, once their practice gets big or they want more independence, that they move over to the InvestNet platform. That is a common trend. We've seen that for many, many years. And, you know, one, we want to make sure we have at least the tools and products available that they have where they're coming from. So that was one of the ideas behind InvestNet and why it was started, to actually give independent advisors the same tools and resources that somebody from the wires would have. But that is a continuing trend we've seen.
So where are you at with assets now, and where do you think you're going to get?
So we're at a little over $3 trillion in total assets on the platform. And as far as discretionary assets, we're involved in the actual trading, and it is about 200 plus billion. And we're growing double digits for sure every year. And the models business is growing over 30% year over year.
Models.
Models.
I think we're going to come back to this topic.
Great.
Repeatedly. And here's a question I have. So you're 5% owned by BlackRock. They bought a small piece of you back in the day, right?
Yes.
And we've tracked this theme that we call getting closer to the customer. The ETF issuers are looking at the writing on the wall. They're like, man, everybody wants everything for 4 basis points. Those advisor fees over there look pretty juicy. They're 1%. And I'm not saying BlackRock's doing this per se, but like Vanguard's launched an advisory service. So has Schwab.
That's the game.
That is the game. And it feels like they're all trying to own get as close as they can to the advisor. That guarantees flows into their funds. And some of them are actually becoming advisors. So from your perch, how are you seeing that trend develop?
Yeah, I think all the providers want to have strategic relationships with all the gatekeepers or the big providers, and BlackRock's no different. And, you know, I don't want to say what they are doing is just for distribution. The reason they did the investment, it was just slightly under 5%, but was more for technology. So they have a lot of really cool technology tools that they wanted to embed into our platform to make, you know, advice much more streamlined and simple. So they've got some really simple tools that advisors can kind of take shortcuts and get to either models that they want, or they can get advice that they want. So that was really the reason for that. But the closer they can get to us, and that's not just BlackRock, but that's all the providers, that's really where distribution is coming from these days.
And, you know, it's not lost on us too how much data exists in the likes of those end investors. And en masse, when you serve, you know, about a third of the advisory community, you know, rolled up, that's a lot of insight for, you know, fund issuers who are trying to sort of go where the puck is going.
Yeah, I think from you're right, data is a big thing for us. Yeah. And we have a lot of data on all those 100,000 advisors, but all the trends of the flows that we're seeing from all the different asset managers. So for those, and we make that information available to the asset managers so they can be much more targeted when they're going after new assets, and they know which advisors are selling more of their products and how many proposals are being run every day from on their individual securities. And so that instead of, from a retail standpoint, just trying to put out commercials and trying to, you know, blanket everywhere, they can be very targeted on, you know, different organizations and figure out, you know, where am I best using my resources.
Let's talk about the models that are, you said there's over 1,000 available, right, on the platform?
So there's 150 providers, asset managers, that have about 1,500
right.
individual models on the platform.
The 100, so BlackRock's one of those, right?
Yes.
Okay. And then you've got companies that like CLS that only does this, where... Also, there's models that are for long term, but then there's models that are trying to outperform, right? Like a fund of funds, is that right? And do you have like a separate section in the proverbial food store for the alpha generating ones versus the long term ones?
Yeah, so when we're working with an enterprise and they want to set up models, they're not going to turn on all 150 organizations' models in that 1,500. They're going to say, all right, we want a low-cost solution, we want an income solution, we want a strategic solution, we want a tactical solution, we want an ESG solution, and they may end up with 5, 6, 10 different types of solutions that all have several different model portfolios attached to it. So it really depends on the distribution chain, the type of advisors that they have, what the demand is. And so we help them curate that list down to something that's more reasonable so the advisors don't have overwhelming choice.
What other trends in ETFs do you think warrant discussion?
A couple of areas that I think we're seeing trends that are very strong right now. We talk about ETF models. In some cases, they're open architecture models. So we'll have a third party picking the best ETFs that are out there. But more and more, our top two organizations and flows are all coming from firms that are only using their proprietary ETFs. So they're, you know, they may not have a selection that's, you know, completely broad and can cover all the different areas, but it's cheap, right? And there's no management fee on top of it. So our advisors look at those models as the free ones. So they don't have to pay a management fee, just the underlying expenses on those models. So those, from a cost standpoint, are very attractive. They know the brand names of these big ETF shops. So they're happy to make those available to their clients. So the free, I think, is one of the big trends we're seeing right now.
Yeah. No, Bank of New York is rolling out ETFs, and one of them is 0.00%. JP Morgan's is 2 basis points. I mean, people are just – look, in the future, everybody's just going to expect the core, at least, of their portfolio to be pretty much free, right?
Yeah. So you know, what I'm talking about is a management fee on top. Right?
Oh, right.
So traditionally, a lot of the models –
like, in other words, they would waive that because you're putting it into their funds.
Exactly.
Gotcha.
Exactly.
Which would probably include some of the non-free ones.
right.
But fair enough, though.
But you're right. There's
also
cheap. The underlying is, you know, raised to zero. So if your underlying costs are 12 basis points or 14 basis points, you know, that's hard to compete with.
This is a hard question, but, you know, do you think it's concerning either overall or for your business as well, just the share that BlackRock and Vanguard have of passive management?
And I don't think it's a concern. You know, I think it's a hard entrance point. There's barriers to entry if you just want to go after low cost strategic ETF models, right? They have a lot of resources. They're doing a very good job in that space. But I also think there's a lot of opportunity for other ETF manufacturers to, you know, look at smart beta models or ESG models or whatever it might be that, you know, that there aren't great options out there in the space for. So they're big, they're doing a good job of it, they've got lots of liquidity, they've got lots of support. You know, I'm not concerned about that at this point.
And one other one, you know, you have obviously a huge research team. How are your capabilities going to have to change with sort of maybe more evaluation of active managers?
Yeah, that's something we have been working on a lot lately. So traditionally, we've done more quantitative screening for traditional ETFs. But now, as you're moving into multi-factor ETFs, you're moving into these non-transparent ETFs, you really have to have somebody looking deep under the hood to understand how that structure works. And so when we're making recommendations, it's not just, you know, looking at these three or five different factors. We actually have to understand the team better, just like you would on a traditional mutual fund or the old school, you know, asset managers. That's, you know, what is their investment philosophy? How is it working? So it's certainly evolving, and our resources are shifting more onto the ETF side from a research standpoint.
Tim, thanks for joining us in Trillions.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to Trillions. Until next time, you can find us on the Bloomberg Terminal, Bloomberg.com, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever else you like to listen. We'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter. I'm at Joel Weber Show. He's at Eric Balchunas. And you can find Morgan at mbarna6. And you can follow InvestNet at envintel. This episode of Trillions was produced by Magnus Hendrickson. Francesca Levy is the head of Bloomberg Podcast. Bye.
You don't have to be a rocket scientist to help realize a mission to Mars. Become an agent of innovation with Invesco QQQ. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.